It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for being here. We're talking about the working conditions for graduate students on college campuses and a recent probe of a lab inside the UW-Madison College of Engineering. 3 years ago this month, electrical engineering doctoral student John Brady took his life. He had been a research assistant in a lab that was described by his peers as toxic and abusive. The UW made changes in the wake of his death. Are you a grad student or postdoc, or have you been one in the past? Do you think the way that universities treat grad researchers and workers is fair, or do you think there are policies that need to change? We're at 800-642-1234. Kelly Meyerhofer covers higher education for the Wisconsin State Journal. Kelly, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate.
Well, the parents of John Brady and those close to him feel that his death was linked to the environment he was facing at his job in the engineering professor Akbar Saeed's lab. What kind of environment was that for students there in the lab?
Yeah, I mean, after John Brady's death, his father, you know, was pouring through his son's laptop files. He found secret recordings his son had taken of the professor yelling at him and others, swearing. He found a document that his son had written sort of describing the lab's conditions and how it was completely imploding. The tabs that he had left open on his browser when the time that he died by suicide, there were UW-Madison policies on workplace violence and hazardous employment, a Wikipedia page on gaslighting, and a Google search for NSF grant abusive, which is likely a reference to the National Science Foundation, which funded most of the professor's work.
And this type of environment went on for years. How was that possible?
Yeah, I mean, the college leadership said that they really didn't have many indications that there was a problem in the lab. It was only after the College of Engineering dean called the family to offer his condolences that the father, Jim Brady, told them of this professor's behavior, and that is when an investigation launched. I think, you know, and the report outlines some of the gaps in oversight that led to these conditions persisting for about 4 years, is that there was no one monitoring either the turnover of students that were leaving the lab, no one evaluating the lab's climate or the mentoring function of professors.
It was unregulated in a way.
Yes.
We're talking about working conditions of grad students at the UW and the reporting by Kelly Meyerhofer. She covers higher education for the Wisconsin State Journal. You can join in. Do you work in academia? How do you feel about the conditions that graduate students work in? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Kelly, what changes has the university made in response to the investigation and since John Brady's death in 2016?
Sure. The College of Engineering, they launched a new survey tool this January 2019. Graduate students can sort of evaluate their own work progress and also solicit feedback from the advisors. But the most important thing, you know, that's part of the software is that there's a box they can check on the survey to confidentially request a meeting with college leaders without their advisor knowing that they're requesting it.
Do we know what that has led to, or has that been enough for what graduate students feel?
Well, I mean, the college's perspective is that, you know, in the first year of the launch, you know, roughly 90% of students in the college took the survey, and there were just a handful of cases relating to work conditions, and all of them ended positively. They were able to sort that out. You know, it's unclear if this sort of survey and avenue for students to confidentially request meetings with leadership is seen across, you know, all of campus. I don't think it is. The university didn't mention that to me in my reporting.
They also raised graduate student worker stipends. What impact did that make?
Yeah, I mean, you hear a lot, you know, particularly from the graduate student union on campus about they're protesting often or holding sit-ins to protest low pay and work conditions. And I think, the university has focused a lot on students' financial struggles over the past several years. They've raised stipends, between 22 and 42%. When it comes to work conditions, I think it's just inherently more difficult to track progress in that area.
Some of the changes the university made is related to mental health care. They had hired 10 more mental health providers. The UW-Madison Grad Student Union tweeted in response to your article, "Mental health services are important, but so is changing the structural factors that lead to abuse and mental health issues in the first place." Can you help us understand that tension there?
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting point. A student's relationship, with his or her mentor is often said to be the greatest predictor of success, but those relationships are generally unregulated. And because, the professor has tenure, it just, they have significant control over their students' career prospects, and it creates little incentive for grad students to report inappropriate behavior because their advisor has so many more job protections than them.
What is the impact of tenure here in this conversation? What did you find?
That's something I'm hoping to dig into a little bit more. I mean, the professor was tenured, so I mean, I don't know what to say beyond that. Is, these were grad students who were trying to obviously graduate with a degree in several years, and he had significant power over them,
To power over their future, basically, as to whether they will be able to complete their program.
Correct. Yeah, and there's some evidence, in the report. This specific student, John Brady, he was in his seventh year on campus in a program that typically lasts 5 or 6. Other students, said that they felt like that their degree was sort of being dragged out as well, and they were just all working on the project.
The university also updated policies related to graduate student employment, and this is something that the Graduate Student Union has been pushing for a long time. Can you explain what the graduate assistant policies and procedures are and why the university updated them?
Sure. So there were policies before Act 10 that the Graduate Student Union had with the university. Once Act 10 happened, those policies sort of expired, and the university and grad students have been working on these policies for several years now. They did approve the policies the university did last spring for teaching and project assistance, but when it comes to research assistants, which is often, the group like that John Brady fell into, where they're working in a lab on work that's directly tied to their thesis or dissertation. The university has not, approved a policy for them yet, because their position's sort of unique and that's still being worked out.
We're talking about the treatment of graduate students and the environment in a lab at UW-Madison 3 years after the suicide of electrical engineering doctoral student John Brady. Wisconsin State Journal higher education reporter Kelly Meyerhofer broke the story on the campus climate for grad students, and she stays with us. What do you think universities need to do to protect grad students? What do they get right? Where do they fall short? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email your thoughts to ideas@wpr.org. We'll get back to this conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and we're talking about the working conditions for grad students on college campuses, specifically a situation at UW-Madison that led to changes. And in preparing for this, I was thinking about my own grad school TA environment. It was so positive, such a good kind of challenge in every way. And that was a direct reflection of my advisor, who was also my boss. But I also remember the suicide of Harvard chemistry PhD student Jason Alsum 2 decades ago at the same time I was in grad school, and his death was covered extensively by the New York Times. It sparked a wave of changes in his department, including the creation of a 3-member committee to monitor grad students' progress and free access to counseling, confidential counseling. One of his suicide notes said, "This event could have been avoided. Professors here have too much power over the lives of their grad students." So what do you think about the environment for grad students today? We're at 800-642-1234. Kelly Meyerhofer covers higher education for the Wisconsin State Journal, and she stays with us. Kelly, the professor in this case, Akbar Saeed, had grants from the National Science Foundation. The university didn't tell the NSF about any of this. So Saeed continued to work for the NSF during his unpaid leave from UW-Madison. How has this been addressed?
Yeah, I mean, we pieced together a timeline showing that right before his 2-year unpaid leave began, UW-Madison signed off on his job with NSF and provided the agency with salary information, but no information about the problems in the lab, including the suicide of John Brady.
And apparently, Professor Saeed's appointment with the NSF, ended after 8 months. You had a follow up to this story yesterday. What did you find out from the NSF?
Yeah, they reached out to me after my initial story published and said, they were able to provide more information and say that they terminated his assignment. They terminated his assignment the same month that a report was released to me in response to a records request. And that's when they received the report from the university as well.
And he also plans to return to the university in January. Is that right?
Yeah, his leave ends December 31st, and he's indicated to the College of Engineering that he plans to return. The university does have some safeguards in place for that when he does return, and if he has a research group, students will have be overseen by an outside committee, sort of overseeing the work climate there.
Well, let's take a call now. Adria is joining us from Madison. Hi, Adria.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind here?
Well, I'm an electrical engineering doctoral student at UW-Madison. I knew John. And just in general, I want to say that I think a lot of the grads, certainly don't want to speak for everyone, but we're pretty upset about all of this, not only coming to understand the conditions surrounding John's death and regrieving that loss again, but also that we were not told earlier and that the administration has not been including us in creating the new policies that they're putting in place. I've been a leader in the labor union over the last several years, and I can say that lack of inclusion of grads is pretty systemic all across UW. I've served on the committee that helped to put in place the graduate assistance policies and procedures, and some of the sessions were really great, and we made good progress, and then other sessions, I think the grads walked away feeling like our voices don't really matter and that administration is not listening to us on some key issues.
What might those key issues be, Adria?
Well, I mean, for example, with the RA policies that they're still working on, issues like being able to report some issues in an anonymous way that we're experiencing with our advisor. But more than that, I think a lot of the focus has been on the ability for the grad to report, but there isn't necessarily anything in place to support the grad if we make that decision. So it's not just about worrying our advisors might retaliate against us. It's also about, okay, well, if we do get our advisors fired, then our funding might go away. Or worry for those of us who are international students, we might lose our visa status. So these are the types of concerns that grads have. So we need to know that if we do report and if there is retaliatory action against our advisors, that there's going to be some means in place of university or department support for us.
Kelly,
I think the electrical engineering department is coming through with those, but I'm not sure that the university as a whole is.
Adria, thank you so much for these insights. Kelly, go ahead.
I think you raise a lot of great points, Adria, that maybe I hadn't even thought of before, particularly the international students and their visas. What I've heard from the university regarding, the policy for research students is that they're still working on a draft, and they say that it's going to be broadly shared before approval, and you know, it's going to be shared with graduate students too.
And I think, Adria, with the point that you make about funding and labs and the funding being tied to grants that can be so precarious, you know, if you don't get the funding for that grant, the lab could go away. Are those things on your mind, Adria?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's definitely the perceived understanding of most graduates. Whether or not departments do have safeguards in place for this, they haven't communicated it to us, but that's one of the main reasons that grads do not report this type of behavior, fear of their funding going away, and then also this type of behavior is just normalized. And if we talk to our peers in other labs, like, oh yeah, I've experienced similar things, or last week I was asked to babysit for my advisor. I mean, there's pretty egregious things that happen on campus, and we just assume that's the way it's supposed to be.
Adria, when will you finish? When will you complete your program? Do you have a time in mind?
I plan to be done this summer, 2020.
Thank you so much for calling in. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're talking about the working conditions for grad students on college campuses. Kelly Meyerhofer broke this story on UW-Madison's College of Engineering. You can join in 800-642-1234. Kelly, after your article came out, grad students around the country got in touch with you. What did they have to say?
Yeah, you mean the university's perspective is that, you know, this is an extreme and isolated case that doesn't, you know, reflect widely of students' experiences on campus. You know, I did hear from quite a few people across the country and at UW, you know, with stories about how they were taken advantage of or that they worked in a lab environment that they said led to their own mental health problems. I was surprised by the extent of, you know, how many stories were shared with me.
Will you do additional reporting on this? Where does it go next?
Yeah, I think that's sort of what I'm still figuring out right now and in the process of. But I think there's definitely, you know, a larger story here about, you know, graduate student worker conditions and what can be done to improve them.
The College of Engineering and the department where Professor Akbar Saeed is employed, they're making changes, as you've discussed, including monitoring turnover and training new faculty on how to mentor graduate students. What should they be watching for in turnover? What turnover is normal?
That's a good question, and one I didn't, you know, dive into completely, but I know, you know, in this particular lab that, students were just constantly, you know, cycling in and out of the lab. Some, you know, came and left within a couple of months, even though it meant losing their financial stipend that would keep them there. So, I mean, it needs to be more closely monitored.
I want to shift gears here for a moment. You have a story out this morning on college athletes and that could you receive pay. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're reporting on there?
Sure. So there's a bill that several lawmakers are working on. It reflects a lot of what the national conversation is about that started when California passed a law that would allow college students to profit off of their fame. Basically, it makes it illegal for state universities to revoke an athlete's scholarship or eligibility for taking money through endorsements or, you know, advertising for a company on a social media, something like that. So it's being planned to be publicly released next week.
What is the situation for student athletes right now? They aren't able to receive any pay.
Right. I mean, the NCAA's, you know, longstanding philosophy has been that, you know, within the collegiate model, they shouldn't be compensated, you know, beyond the cost of attending a university and receiving a scholarship. There's sort of been a shift in the national conversation with all of the demands that athletes, you know, have on their bodies and, you know, concussions and that whole conversation that, you know, they deserve more than what they're getting from institutions and from the NCAA.
Kelly, thanks for your reporting. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Kate.
Kelly Meyerhofer covers higher education for the Wisconsin State Journal. In response to her reporting, UW-Madison Provost John Carl Schultz issued a statement, and it reads in part, "No student should ever experience the behavior that was found to have occurred. This situation highlights why it's vital that university, college, and departmental leaders empower students and staff to speak up if they experience a negative study or work environment. We take reports seriously and we will act." If you or someone you know might be contemplating suicide, contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That number, 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. You can text HOME to 741-741 to reach the Crisis Text Live. Coming up, you have a line to Representative Barbara Dietrich as we discuss eight bills addressing the adoption process. We'll look at the bill package right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The U.S. House of Representatives will hold a vote this morning to formalize the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. NPR News will bring coverage of that vote, and you can hear it on WPR.org starting at 8 o'clock this morning. Right now, we're talking about a package of adoption bills. The 16-member Speaker's Task Force on Adoption was charged with specific areas to focus on to improve the adoption process in Wisconsin. Comes down to time, cost, access to resources, and taking a closer look at terminating parental rights. And this last piece is facing stiff criticism. Have you seen the eight proposed adoption bills? Do you support them? Have you been through Wisconsin's adoption system? What was your experience? We're at 800-642-1234. Representative Barbara Dietrich is a Republican State Assembly member from Oconomowoc. She represents District 38, which covers Oconomowoc, Lake Mills, parts of Deerfield and Marshall, and she chairs the Speaker's Task Force on Adoption. Representative Dietrich, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you held multiple hearings over the summer, heard from many families. What did you learn from Wisconsin residents on adoption?
Well, quite a bit. We heard from stakeholders at every side of this issue. So it was pretty thorough. We held seven hearings around the state. We began in Madison with an informational hearing with the Department of Children and Families, as well as other organizations like Children's Hospital, some of the social service agencies and adoption providers, just to even get everyone on the same page with language regarding adoption and what the process actually looks like. One of the things I think that most people, when they think about adoption and the challenges with adoption in this state, everybody's heard that story about the really expensive private adoption. But most adoptions in the state of Wisconsin are public adoptions, the vast majority. And so it was very clear early on that that was where we needed to really start focusing our attention and energy. And I will tell you, I feel that the task force did really well in bipartisan fashion. So that was refreshing to see.
So as you went around the state, you probably heard some reoccurring themes. What did you hear? What were some of those reoccurring things that came up?
I hate to say this, but the number one recurring theme we heard without fail at not one, but every single hearing was the drug crisis in Wisconsin. The children of the state are being deeply, deeply affected by drug abuse in this state. And we're not just talking opioids. We're talking meth. It's problematic. And it may look a little different in different parts of the state, depending on what the drug of choice is, if you will. but it is creating horrible results for these children. And it's not just neglect in the home. It's having needles and substances within reach of children that is putting them at tremendous risk. So I think that was disturbing to every task force member, and each of us feel compelled to do something to help make this better, not just for the children, but for the adults that are resorting to drug abuse.
How did this hearing about the drug abuse translate into the legislation that you wrote through these eight bills? Where did that translate?
Well, first, let me tell you that before we can do anything regarding adoption, there is federal legislation called the Firm Family First Act. And what that does is really attempts to keep families united. And what that may look like is a parent receiving treatment for that drug abuse without the child being removed from the home. The challenge is that Wisconsin has not implemented that program yet. And so we are really awaiting action on that. That being said, there were some thoughts about creating grounds for terminating parental rights based on a drug-affected child. Grounds for terminating parental rights based on incarceration of the parent for the length of the child's life. We want families to be reunited, definitely. That is the gold standard, is to have those closest to the family be involved in that child's life.
Representative, there's been opposition to aspects of these proposals. One of the bills created, as you're talking about, the grounds to terminate parental rights if a mother uses drugs or alcohol while she's pregnant, unless the mother enrolls in a treatment program within 90 days of the child's birth. The bill would also create grounds to terminate parental rights if a parent, as you mentioned, is incarcerated and likely to stay in prison during the years the child is a minor. So what would you say to those who think these limitations are too harsh?
Well, I would tell you that, number one, the legislation that has been released is definitely still in progress. In other words, these bills are being amended as we speak today, because we don't want things to come across as too harsh. At the same time, I would tell you that our children cannot wait. The average, if you look at it, full recovery can take up to 8 years in best case scenarios. And that really can be the lifetime of a child. So we have to find a balance. And that, I think, is what our task force has worked really hard on in a bipartisan way, is to find that balance between getting people help and between really giving more focus to the best interest of that child. Sadly, it seems we have swung the pendulum so much in the direction of being most concerned about the adults and the adults' rights. And from what we saw in our hearings, it really has come at a high price to our children. And it's creating great trauma.
We're talking about a package of adoption bills with Representative Barbara Dietrich of Oconomowoc. She chairs the Speaker's Task Force on Adoption. You can join in. Have you seen the 8 bills proposed on adoption? What do you think of them? Have you been through our state's adoption system? What was your experience like? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Representative, one of Speaker Robin Voss's goals in establishing the task force was identifying ways to shorten the timeline for adoptions. Mm-hmm. What makes adoption a lengthy process?
Ooh, there are many parts of, and I'm going to state this maybe in an overly simplified way, so forgive me if people are familiar with this process. But in many points along the way, the process can go back to square one and be delayed. And so many of the bills address those technicalities. For instance, initially, children tend to be removed from the home through something called a CHIPS, or Child in Need of Protective Services order. And that's where things start out. Our goal, and from what we heard from stakeholders involved, is the sooner that we create positive tools and positive support on that front side, when that child is removed, the shorter we will make the process overall. The law says that if a child has been out of the home 15 of 22 months, that termination of parental rights must be initiated. Now, that can get kicked back to square one for a number of different reasons. And it gets rather technical, but really we talk a great deal with Representative Pat Snyder and Representative Steve Doyle, who chaired the task force on foster care last legislative session.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of this work springboards off of what these two gentlemen really spearheaded back in that session. And for example, one of the bills creates a right to counsel on the front side in the CHIPS process.
And we're going to pause. We have to pause right there, talking with Representative Barbara Dietrich of Oconomowoc about 8 bills addressing Wisconsin's adoption process. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment. Stay with us. More conversation on the Ideas Network. We're talking about an adoption bill package that is the product of an assembly task force. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And the goal is to increase adoptions in Wisconsin to respond to a growing need. There were 723 children adopted in the 2018 fiscal year. Hundreds of children are waiting to be adopted, and that's from state data. Lawmakers on the task force, they traveled around the state this summer holding public hearings, talking with families. Have you been through Wisconsin's adoption system? What was your experience? What improvements do you think could be made? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Representative Barbara Dietrich stays with us, and she chairs the task force. Let's go to the phones now. Heidi is joining us from Madison. Hi, Heidi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say I think it's really about time that there's legislation that focuses on the child, because a lot of these kids that could be growing up in loving, stable environments, and they're just kind of left in limbo, you know, while parents kind of, you know, get their stuff together. And I understand everybody goes through things. But I know I've had friends go through the adoption process, And she's right. It's very frustrating because you can go back to square one at any time. And then even when it's finalized, you've still got that waiting period.
Heidi, thanks for the call. Representative Dietrich, Heidi, seems like this legislation is right on.
Yes, and that's much of what we heard in public testimony, as well as I would tell you, interestingly, we found that our courts in the state are really now trained on trauma-informed care. I think we've heard a lot of that in a lot of different pieces of our state life, if you will, and those courts are really trained now to have that sensitivity to what's going on so that we are respectful of everyone involved and yet trying to get those children help. It is still tremendously frustrating for foster parents and for those wishing to adopt these children who need that stability and just that forever care.
Let's go to Tim now in Janesville with thoughts on this. Hi, Tim.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Just want to express some concerns about one of the bills that allows foster parents to be a party to the case in a change of placement hearing, and also would change the statutory language to emphasize that it's in best interest of the children versus that it's in the best interest of children to be with relatives. I just want to emphasize how important it is when kids cannot remain with their parents that they be placed with relatives. And I think changing this statute to make parents, foster parents, specifically non-relative foster parents, a party to the case would be a huge mistake for kids and families, because we know by research that when kids are removed from the home, the best outcomes are when they're placed with relatives, not in stranger foster care. Thank you.
Tim, thank you for the call. Representative Dietrich, your thoughts on what Tim is saying there about children needing to stay with relatives?
I would say, for the most part, the task force agrees with Tim. And again, these bills are in the process of being amended and working out some of those concerns that Tim just expressed. Most children, when they are removed from the home and placed for adoption in this state, do stay with a relative and are adopted by a relative. That's the great news. And isn't that what we would all want? I would say our native tribes in the state have great models for extended family involvement in that child's life, which is the ultimate outcome. At the same time, we have to, and again, we're still trying to work these kinks out with the bills. We do need to have some consideration for foster parents and the incredible responsibility and sacrifice they make. And really, we heard in these hearings that they would like a voice in this process. They feel very shut out while being given all of the responsibility. So that is the very nuanced challenge we're trying to address these pieces of legislation.
You mentioned tribal nations, and in previous testimony on this, the Ho-Chunk Nation expressed concern about this adoption legislation, and they stressed the importance of keeping families together. Do these bills run against that premise of trying to keep families together?
No, they don't. And here's why I would say that. First off, I met with the Ho-Chunk Nation right before they testified, and we had a lovely conversation. And I expressed to them, as I would to any of the tribes, is that we want them at the table to help us work out any problems with these pieces of legislation so we can make them the best possible for everyone involved. Secondly, I want to remind you of one thing I said earlier, and that is the federal Family First legislation. And we must comply with that. Anything we do cannot go against that legislation, or we will have deep trouble in this state. And it's something we are committed to here in Wisconsin.
We're talking about a package of eight bills on adoption with Representative Barbara Dietrich of Oconomowoc. She chairs the Speaker's Task Force on Adoption. You can join in 800-642-1234. Ashley now is joining us from Coloma. Hi, Ashley.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a question in regards to my oldest daughter is not biologically my husband. However, we have two other kids together. And last I looked into what it would take for him to legally adopt her so that way he would have a say in parental decisions should I not be able to do so. It was quite a rigorous and expensive process. I mean, so much so that our home would have to be subject to home inspections just for my husband to adopt our oldest. So I'm wondering, has there been any changes? Are they looking into changes to streamline this?
Ashley, thanks for the call. Representative Dietrich, these are, you know, big life decisions here. And Ashley feels really hampered by the process.
And thank you for calling, Ashley. I would encourage you to reach out to my office on that. One thing I've been telling people is that this task force, in my mind, is just the beginning. Because look, in just the short time we spent together this morning, what a huge, huge issue adoption is. So that is not something, what Ashley brought up is not something we addressed in this task force. Because as you mentioned, there are only eight bills. We're just getting started. So I don't even see this as a situation that is restrained to this legislative session. I see that this is just the beginning of Wisconsin really working on making this better in years to come and legislative sessions.
And so, yeah, this was discussed in a public hearing before the State Assembly's Committee on Family and Law on Tuesday. What's next in the legislative process for these bills and the changes that are being made to them?
So the next piece of the process is actually last night, worked later into the evening with both Republicans and Democrats, discussing challenges, discussing what we heard in the hearing on Tuesday, the feedback we heard. And so really, legislative counsel is going through these and helping to guide us in making any appropriate amendments that really need to be made with these bills.
Representative Dietrich, we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Representative Barbara Dietrich is a Republican state assembly member from Oconomowoc. We've been talking about a bill package meant to improve the in-state adoption process, and she chairs the Speaker's Task Force on Adoption. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.